This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. From Abraham Lincoln's looming, pensive figure at his monument in D.C. to the four presidential faces staring out at eternity from Mount Rushmore, bigger-than-life presidential memorials have long been popular among Americans. And our guest today says how we honor these leaders often reveals more about us than the men themselves. We're talking this hour with our own Brady Carlson, NHPR's Weekend Edition host and author of the brand-new book, Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. In his book, Carlson describes how many of these grand memorials and presidential libraries came to be, but he also uncovers the quieter and definitely quirkier ways we remember our commanders-in-chief, from bobbleheads and games to pocket-sized souvenirs that seem to bring these great men down to our level and at times even cut them down to size. Brady Carlson joins us this hour with some little-known backstories of presidential memorials and what they say about their men and America. And let's hear from you. Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Brady, what a treat to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, this book picks up, Brady, where other presidential histories leave off. You start your story when the president dies. So it's not so much about their lives. It's about their afterlives. What's the afterlife of a dead president?
Isn't it fascinating? You know, and it is something that, you know, took a little bit of digging to find, because most books wrap up where the president passes away. And there's a page or two about the death and the funeral, and then maybe a little bit about the legacy. But there is this whole extra world. I call it the post-post-presidency, because it continues on. And there is this large... It's a network of monuments and memorials, but it's also really just about the concept of what the presidency means to us. We put – there's an old saying about how the story – that history is the story of the present told through the past. And really what we do is we put the presidents of the past in the context of the present, what they mean to us now, and the issues that they stood for, the things that mattered in their time, and how they relate to us in our time. So there's this just ongoing process that we actively do, even if we don't know we're doing it.
And you say in the book, I hope I'm saying this correctly, Brady, that, you know, being an afterlife president is a busy job.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you think you've done your work and then you get to rest, right? But they don't rest. We really do keep them working.
How so?
Well, for one thing, on a very practical level, we name things after them constantly. And most of those are pretty non-consequential. You know, naming an elementary school after a president is usually something that people do without a whole lot of debate. But we saw an example last year when President Obama renamed the highest mountain in Alaska from Mount McKinley to Denali. And there was a great deal of pushback on that from people in Ohio. President McKinley was from Ohio. He's buried in Canton on this enormous hilltop tomb. And they didn't want to lose that monument to one of their home state presidents. So I remember our colleague Rick Ganley had Governor John Kasich on when he was visiting New Hampshire for his presidential campaign. And he said, if I'm elected, I vow that I will change the name back to honor President McKinley so that Ohio still has that monument in Alaska. We had an example of that about a decade ago in this state when there was an effort to add a mountain in the presidential range to Mount Reagan. And there was pushback there as well. They tried again in Nevada, same debate. There was pushback from Democrats in Nevada on that. So you see some controversy about just on the level of naming things after presidents, much less any of the other issues that come up in the world of the dead presidency.
So again and again, Brady, and this is one of the central themes of your book, you point out how these memorials, these afterlives, really do say as much about us as Americans as they do about the men themselves. There are dozens of examples, Brady, but just give us a couple, please. What are a few examples of this that stand out?
Well, I think of the way that we memorialize the presidents is really twofold. I mean, we want to build them up because the presidency is the one person in the whole country who represents everyone. Everybody has the chance to elect the president. Everybody is theoretically represented by the president, and the president is the only one who can claim a mandate from the people in a way that no other elected official can. And that's important. It's, you know, at the heart of our democratic traditions and our ideals about what America means to have a representative leader. And so we go big oftentimes. Mount Rushmore is the biggest example of that. The heads are 12 times the size of a human head. At the same time, we have the presidents as one of the few cultural components that we all have in common. We don't watch the same TV shows. We don't read the same books. We don't listen to the same bands. But we all have that same list of presidents. And so we put them on Pez dispensers and on cereal boxes for trivia for kids and you know, some just really bizarre and not necessarily poor meaning memorials, but some things that, you know, that are not really the speaking to those better angels of our nature. You know, we'll have little action figures or just bizarre components that show up in towns across the country.
Well, and you're right, Brady, that sometimes the culture wants to give a certain president a certain kind of afterlife, whereas the president himself really didn't want that kind of afterlife. And the prime example I'm thinking of is George Washington.
George Washington basically wanted to be left alone. He'd done his time. And the guides at Mount Vernon, his plantation in Virginia, will point that out. They say, here's a man who, you know, gave 22 years of service to his nation, often putting his own personal feelings aside. He didn't really want to be away from his what he saw as his work running that plantation. He didn't want to be away from that. He didn't want to be away from his wife and their family. But he felt, this is what I need to do, and there are certain things that only George Washington could do, so I'm going to go do them. Well, in his will, he said, I want to be buried at Mount Vernon. I want to be left alone. I don't want to have a big funeral. I don't want everybody to flip out about it. But George Washington was at that time such a singular figure that people were worried that without a George Washington there physically to bind the country together through his force of personality and his reputation, that the different sections of the country might start to split apart. And so they went, long story short, over the top on the funeral and the mourning and the memorializing in the wake of George Washington's death, in a way turning him into a figure who was larger than life. Because if he was a mere mortal man, you lose George Washington, you worry that people will break apart. But if he's bigger than life, if he's a figure that is transcending the physical form and as becomes the stuff of legend, you never lose him. You hang on to him, and then he's always there to, quote-unquote, guide you.
Well, that's really interesting. And there are a couple of funny stories, though, about, I mean, again, poor George Washington. You know, the phrase, rolling over his grave, saying, no, no, no. For example, there was a sculpture that was commissioned of George Washington after he died. And you know, the idea was noble to make him grand and everlasting, as you say, Brady, but it was a flop.
Yeah, it was intended to make George Washington into Cincinnatus, that figure from Roman times who was a farmer who was given absolute power for a very short period of time to save Rome, and then
just like George Washington,
voluntarily gave it back to go back to being a private citizen. And they wanted to represent George Washington in that way. But the idea of seeing George Washington, a figure of the 1700s, in a toga, just it didn't quite work for people. It was a little too concrete in a way. And so it was originally placed in the Capitol Rotunda, and they moved it outside. Officially, they said, well, it's just too heavy for the floor. But it was more because so many people were laughing at it that it just didn't go over well. And it was sort of bounced around Washington, D.C. for a time. It's in the Smithsonian Museum of American History now. And while it's not necessarily the jewel of the collection even today, it's certainly worth seeing because it gives you that window into how people saw George Washington.
Well, seeing him in a toga, again, in those times was weird. One writer said he looks like he's coming out of the bath and we can see his bare chest. That just didn't sit right with folks.
It was just too much because, yes, I mean, the link back to the democratic and republican traditions of ancient Greece and ancient Rome were strong, and people did talk about America's governmental system in that way. But, yeah, having him in those, that just struck a little too close to the sort of Julius Caesar style outfits, I think, for people's tastes.
Well, and the broader idea that you're presenting, Brady, that, you know, people built George Washington up, gave him this huge afterlife, even though he didn't want it, as a way to keep this very brand new and fragile nation together. This comes up time and time again, too, in the book, Brady, the use of the presidential afterlife for political purposes. This happened after Lincoln's death as well. Secretary of War Stanton, who adored Lincoln, used his funeral and afterlife in a very political way.
He wanted to show the North what Southerners had done. And he included the assassin, John Wilkes Booth, as he considered him to be the prime example of what Southerners had done to the country. They had not only torn it apart, they had not only led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of men and some women and just caused this great catastrophe in the country, but then they had murdered the president. And he wanted it known that it was not just a lone person who assassinated the president, that it was that frenzy and that feeling and that sentiment throughout the South that was just as guilty as the man who pulled the trigger. And so he put Lincoln's body on a train back to Springfield, Illinois, not just for burial, but for public receptions in each of the big northern cities. So
yeah,
that people could
ride.
Not only mourn, but they could see for themselves what that assassin and the South had done to what in his mind was us, the Union, the country.
So on the face of it, it was, you know, let each town or city that we go through honor Father Abraham, you know, the great reconciler. But the political goal was to whip up anti-Southern sentiment after the Civil War and to sort of harden Northern resolve against the South.
Absolutely. And at the same time, what was interesting was that people often forget that Lincoln was not a widely adored figure while he was alive and in the White House. There were editorials even up on the day before he died criticizing his conduct of the war, his handling of the government, and just his overall personality and his tone while in office. After he died, all of that changes. And through the course of that 2 weeks on the train trip, the sort of death tour of the North, Lincoln becomes, like Washington, a larger-than-life figure, a sort of mythical being who becomes an essential part of America's story about itself.
And like Washington, my understanding from your book is, Brady, Lincoln did not want the reconciliation to be harsh. He wanted the North and South to come together as, you know, a family that had a feud and now we're coming together. But Stanton used this very differently from what Lincoln would have wished for.
Let him up easy was the way that Lincoln was said to have described. He said, you know, we never really left each other. We just had to figure it out. And there were a lot of people in his own Republican Party who felt very differently and wanted the South to be treated very harshly. One of the big questions that people often ask about Lincoln is how well would he have been regarded had he not been shot, had he lived through his second term and then had to deal with these very difficult questions of how to deal with the South in the aftermath of the Civil War. His successor, Andrew Johnson, who did deal with those questions, has not fared well and is almost completely forgotten as a dead president.
Well, again, it's interesting because so often we hear about the impact of these administrations, but you're telling us, Brady, especially in the case of Lincoln, that his afterlife, to use that word again, had a strong impact on how American history rolled out from there.
The timing of a death matters. It sometimes can cut a leader who was considered very well known in his time, can cut them down to size and be completely forgotten. In other ways, it can build them up. And even the founding fathers over time have had ebbs and flows in their historical reputations. They have always not been revered in the way that they are today.
Okay, that's tantalizing. And we'll get to that in just a minute. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at NHPR.org. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with NHPR's own Brady Carlson talking about his brand new book, Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. And as we're hearing it, he describes the monumental and sometimes just plain wacky ways we've memorialized our commanders in chief and how the way we honor these leaders often says more about us than them. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. What's your favorite presidential memorial or monument that you visited? Who are some of the unsung presidents that you think deserve more afterlife attention? Again, we'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Brady, here's an email from Richard in Milton. Couple good questions here. Thank you, Richard. He says, some past dead presidents have libraries, memorials, locations, and organizations dedicated to those past presidents. Are past dead presidents recognized for their policies, accomplishments, or their political legacies that shape the U.S. and the world? Also, Richard, by the way, wants to know what criteria determines the past dead presidents being represented on U.S. currency. Let's take that second question first, because you talk about that in the book.
Yeah, the dead presidents were not initially supposed to be on the currency. It's just something that wound up over time. No, there were figures, you know, Native American figures sometimes were used. Pieces of Americana, the buffalo nickel is a great example of that. Just something that was supposed to be characteristically America. And over time, we clearly have shifted toward the presidents. I mean, the best story that I found when I was coming across the stories about currency and coinage was that Franklin Roosevelt work to put Jefferson on the nickel because he was trying to promote the New Deal and he wanted to try and find a link to the founding fathers so that the people who were saying his policies were un-American, were completely radical and out of step with the country, he wanted to have some kind of link back to the past to show that, you know, he was on board with America and that everybody should be on board with his policies. And Jefferson's philosophy of government was in a lot of ways very different from Franklin Roosevelt's. Franklin Roosevelt wanted to push for governmental programs of all kinds at the federal level. Jefferson was much more a small government kind of president. But he said, here's the link. Jefferson and I both believe in the little guy. We believe in the individual being, you know, standing up to authority and having the individual right to succeed in the face of, you know, in Jefferson's time, he saw potential governmental tyranny, and Roosevelt's time, big business and corporate interests. So he was able to put that together. That is the time when you see the Jefferson Memorial come together. That's also the time that you see the Jefferson Nickel come out. And so, you know, that's where that whole system and story starts to come together.
Well, so once again, we see a current president using the afterlife of a dead president for his current political aims.
Of course. Yeah. And it comes up time and time and time again. I mentioned earlier about how the founding fathers not always thought of well. That was really in the progressive era in the early part of the 20th century when the founding fathers were seen as being too limited and not worried enough about the little person in American society and not being able to sort of shift with the times. So their reputation faltered. It came back then when people like Franklin Roosevelt and then also many Republicans as well as Democrats found those kinds of connections. We still see it today. I mean, how often does Ronald Reagan come up in the course of the presidential campaign when we see GOP candidates coming through New Hampshire? I mean, they all say, well, I'm the heir to the legacy of Reagan. I'm the one who's most like Reagan. And you know, Reagan has been off the scene for many years, but he's still a player, even in today's politics.
Well, and speaking of Reagan, there was an attempt, Brady, to put Reagan on some currency, wasn't there?
Yes.
By Grover Norquist. Yeah, tell us about
that. The $10 bill and I think the $20 bill at one point. And then when that failed, they talked about maybe a coin. Maybe you could alternate Roosevelt on the dime with Ronald Reagan. And that still didn't pan out.
Bipartisan compromise.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Democrats find Grover Norquist's efforts to try and name one thing after Ronald Reagan in every one of the some 3,000 counties in the country very objectionable. Although, as you pointed out, that there have been efforts to use past presidents for all sorts of political purposes, and so he's just someone who has sort of formalized this this unofficial process that's been going on for a long time, he sees the value in symbols that if you put Ronald Reagan's name on a prominent airport as opposed to just a small creek or an elementary school somewhere in a rural remote part of the country. That's valuable, you know. In a way, it's good branding, you know. Just visibility is good, but also it's the idea that if you see someone's name and if you see them in a prominent place and if you see them in a place where people are talking about him, then you know people might start to ask those questions. Well, who was this person we're naming things after? He must have been important, and if so, then what are the ideas that made him important, and what was the record? And so that then he can say, well, if Ronald Reagan was such a consequential president, we should continue on with those ideas even after he's gone.
That's the goal of Grover Norquist. That's again, conservative
idea.
Activist, head of the Tax Foundation, and putting Reagan's name out there as much as possible so that people 30, 40, 50, 60 years from now will ask those questions. We will talk a lot more after a short break. Richard, we'll get to your other question in your email. You can email us as well. It's exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, NHPR's Brady Carlson. He's our weekend edition host and reporter here at NHPR and the author of the brand new book that we're talking about today called Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. How do you see our dead presidents being used for political purposes even today? What's your thought on the use of the afterlife, as Brady's describing to us? And by the way, what's your favorite presidential memorial or monument or library that you visited? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Brady, just before the break, we were finishing up with an email from Richard in Milton, who also asked, are past dead presidents recognized for their policies, accomplishments, or for their political legacies that shaped the U.S. and the world? Again, talking about libraries and memorials and so forth. This is a great question because you've got a whole lot in here on presidential libraries and sort of how they're used.
Yeah, it's a great question, Richard. So thank you very much. The presidential library system is the biggest change in the way we remember and memorialize presidents since the founding of the country, really. In the early days, coming back to that idea of who the president is, the president was a private citizen who took on a very important and powerful job for a short period of time, but then voluntarily stepped back into the private world, left that to someone else. And that was initially how dead presidents were treated as well. They were all buried privately, often at home. And that was not necessarily – it was something that was of concern to the country, but it wasn't the country's job to then – memorialize and build monuments to the president. Well, when the presidential library system is first proposed by Franklin Roosevelt in the 1940s, all of that changes because here you have a taxpayer-funded institution designed not simply to carry some national records, but the national records of one particular president and one particular presidency. And not just the official papers and the documents of state, but the knickknacks, the gifts that they received from other heads of state, the personal items that make up their particular character and tone and style. And there have been people, and there were people at the time when that was first proposed. He was still president at the time. He suggested, let's build a museum to me and my presidency. And there were people who said, what is this ancient Egypt? We build monuments to our leaders?
It's a little unseemly. Yeah, there he is in office already making plans.
And here's how he won them over. One, because he had the votes in Congress to do it. But two, he was able to say, this will be a benefit not just to me, but to historians. Because back then, documents of the presidents were private. They were taken with them at the end of their presidency, and often they were either donated or sold to the National Archives. But we didn't have access to them. Historians and scholars couldn't just go through and see how these consequential decisions. Abraham Lincoln's papers weren't available until after Franklin Roosevelt's papers. John Adams,
he had a good point there.
His papers weren't available until about the same time as Franklin Roosevelt's, and those are hundreds of years older. So he was able to say, these institutions will benefit the country. We will learn more about ourselves through the process. Now, of course, he had some personal interest in that. He was something of a hoarder, so he did want a place just to put all his stuff. But presidents like to have a legacy. People don't run for office today and not want to be remembered. So each president after Franklin Roosevelt, and they grandfathered Herbert Hoover in there as well because he was still alive at the time, have a partly federally funded presidential library to house their documents and also tell the story of their presidency. The big criticism continues to be that they are often too friendly to their own subjects, and that's because there's a lot of presidential donors who give to help construct each library, and then they build the initial exhibits and tell that story in a way that's friendly to the president. They want their story to be out there. They want their perspective to be available to people. And you do see over the decades then, institutions will grow and evolve, and historians will put them in new contexts. Franklin Roosevelt's own library just went under an extensive renovation in the last few years, and it talks a lot about the Japanese internment, for example, and some of the more controversial aspects of his presidency. So, and getting back to the idea of why this is important in the world of dead presidents is because most of them are buried on the grounds of their presidential libraries today. And the idea is they're often built near where a president grew up or was born. So the idea is telling the entire story, going full circle from birth to prominence to death and legacy.
Well, it's interesting. So one person you quote in the book says these presidential libraries are, quote, archives of spin, you know, propaganda in museum form. And you seem to be saying, Brady, you know, fair criticism, but as time goes on from that death, historians come in and start to present a fuller, more accurate picture.
That's true, although the person who calls them the Archives of Spin, he wrote a book about presidential libraries, which was essential to me, not only talking with him but reading his research. He says that may or may not still be the case, because what has happened is that in addition to the federally funded National Archives administered presidential libraries, you have a sort of private part of the institutions run by foundations, which are often still very connected to the presidents. You know, in some ways, we see the presidential libraries being a sort of post-presidential headquarters for these individuals. We've seen that especially with, like, Jimmy Carter. The Carter Center has become much more than just a library and museum to the four Carter years, but this springboard where he can do his work with elections and foreign policy and so forth. And the criticism there is that these institutions often these private institutions, the private foundations that contribute to the presidential libraries along with the federal tax money, will be the voice that pushes for the pro-presidential view. When Richard Nixon's presidential library, which was initially private, rejoined the National Archives system, there was a lot of tension between the Nixon Foundation, which was pushing for a very, what they felt, a more fuller picture of the president's accomplishments, maybe not so heavily on Watergate, and the historians who were saying, well, you have to tell the Watergate story if you're going to tell the story of Richard Nixon. And so there has been a lot of tension. Sometimes there are stories where the people of the foundation will be working in the same building as the people of who work for the presidential library, and they won't interface, they won't talk, they won't have lunch together. It's not often the case. It's the exception rather than the rule. But there can be sort of that tension at this, you know, at the same time between one group who wants the president's own version of the story to be
sure.
told and historians who want other voices to be out there as well.
So the politics of the afterlife continues on.
Wow. They can get really hairy.
Again and again. Well, and as you say in the book, you know, for example, FDR just recently at his library, they put in something about the Japanese internment camps, which many people see as the stain, the big stain on the Roosevelt presidency. You also say, you know, Harry Truman gets no free ride at his library.
No. Well, Harry Truman was something of a throwback to that period where presidents were less concerned about trying to get their story out there. He was more just kind of like, I think I did the best I could at the time. If history judges me harshly, well, then so be it. And of course, Harry Truman made the decision to drop two atomic bombs during World War II on two cities in Japan. And one of the big pieces of the Truman Presidential Library in Missouri is an in-depth look at how people view that decision, whether it was the right thing to do and whether it was not. And you have very prominent voices sort of explaining the pros and the cons, the ins and the outs, and the legacy of that decision. And it also, interestingly enough, often presidential libraries try to look backward. They don't always look into the present or into the future. But in Truman's case, they tied some of his decisions in World War II and then in the Korean War to what had happened in the Vietnam War. They said, here's a direct link to what had happened 20 years later, long after Harry Truman had left the political scene. So it's interesting to see how the libraries will sometimes be very critical of some of the decisions that a president made in their own backyard.
Well, one of the things that's fun about these presidential libraries, and I've been to a couple of them, is you feel like you're entering that decade.
Yes.
You know, I remember going to the JFK Library with our kids a couple years ago, and I felt like I was in the 1960s. You know, it was kind of fun.
It's a great way to set context for people who are coming in who may not know a whole lot about a particular president. My favorite is the Gerald Ford Library in Grand Rapids, Michigan, because the first room that you walk into doesn't have any politics in it. It has disco music playing. It has people wearing those 70s bell-bottom pants and the flared outfits, and it has pictures of the TV news anchors of the 1960s. 70s wearing their big sideburns and their large neckties. So it's just a lot of fun to take that trip through memory lane, see what the culture was like at the time before you start to see how the president led or tried to lead through those years.
One more question about presidential libraries, Brady, and then I have a stack of emails here for you. I have to ask you about one presidential library that I have not visited, and that's the LBJ Library. and I'm asking you this, you know why? Because there's a talking robot of LBJ there. What does he say, and is it creepy?
He tells jokes. It's actually not that creepy. I mean, I grew up with those robots that they would have playing music at Showbiz Pizza and Chuck E. Cheese and places like that. So for me to have an animatronic president is kind of right up my alley. But yes, he was originally made not for the library, but for a display on Texas history by the department store Neiman Marcus, which was based in Texas. And they donated it to the library after they were done with their display. It was not intended to be an important part of the museum in any way, just kind of one of those, well, would you believe that there's a joke-telling LBJ robot? And at one point, there was actually talk in the library that maybe it's run its course, maybe we need to move on and let the robot go. And there was a bit of a public outcry. Some people actually compared it to Big Tex, who's a mascot at the Texas State Fair, a very beloved folk character in Texas. And so they kept the robot. And actually, when I went to the library in Austin, Texas, I got there sort of late in the day, and I said, I got to do sort of the 10-cent tour here, folks. What should I see? And they said, start with the robot. I mentioned that to the director of the library when I interviewed him for the book, and he said, yeah, I'm not so thrilled that that was what they pointed you to first, because, you know, he's trying to tell a much larger story. But, you know, in a way, people do attached to the characters of the presidents. We experience them on a person-to-person level, not just on a level of a particular policy or particular issue. But we that's why the presidency in many ways is so powerful, because we feel very personally connected to the people in it. So the idea of having something maybe a little kitschy like a robot or a statue or something like that really does, in a way, engage people and hopefully then gets them to experience the rest of the presidential libraries and museums, really look at those bigger questions.
Go for the robot, stay for the papers.
Stay for the papers, exactly. Perfect.
Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Join us at 1-800-892-6477. Again, today in the exchange, we're sitting down with NHPR's own Brady Carlson on his brand new book, Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. You can join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Bunch of emails, Brady, that I'd like to go through. Here's one from Nick in Hampstead. He says, can you talk a little about presidents who died in office, specifically how their deaths affected their policies? Were those policies enhanced or cast aside? You talked about Lincoln, whose policies Johnson attempted to further, but who was very weak and unsuccessful. It's a great question, Nick. Thank you.
Yeah, and some presidents have had a lot better luck than others. For example, in the aftermath of John F. Kennedy's death, Lyndon Johnson very pointedly said, let us continue. We must continue the work that our president did. And that's how he was able to get a big change to the tax code passed. He was able to get some of the civil rights laws passed, saying there is no greater memorial we can present to President Kennedy than to pass this civil rights bill that he so desperately wanted. And it worked. And that was at a time where people were fighting very, very hard against any further civil rights legislation. So that's an example. Some of the other presidents have had a tougher time with
mixed
it.
Mixed success.
Mixed success. And oftentimes a president who, for example, died very early on in their term, somebody like a James A. Garfield, really didn't have a lot of time to even introduce themselves to the public, much less pass any big legislation. So some have done well and some have done not so well.
Thanks for the question, Nick. Here's a related one from Peggy in Hollis. She says, I have wondered / believed that we would not have Medicare without the tragic assassination of President Kennedy. There was intense opposition from the AMA, the American Medical Association. Yet, Peggy says, it passed with bipartisan support during a time when the country was in mourning and together. Can Brady speak to this?
I can speak just a little tiny bit to that, because I think you can trace a chain of events that begins with Kennedy's assassination to Lyndon Johnson being able to move some big bills through at the end of that term and then win very handily re-election to a second term, and then passing things like Medicaid. It's interesting that we had the great historian Robert Caro, who has written the books on Lyndon Johnson's life and presidency and has won all kinds of accolades for his in-depth research and his fantastic writing. He came to the University of New Hampshire and spoke about Lyndon Johnson and the Kennedy assassination. And I happened to get to ask one of the questions sitting out in the audience. And I said, what is it that Lyndon Johnson would want to be remembered for most? And his answer came without hesitation. He said the war on poverty, things like Medicare, Medicaid, and those kinds of social programs. Of course, that's not quite how he's remembered today. He's remembered just as much for Vietnam as he is for any of those programs that he wanted to. But that's the complicated legacy that a president leaves. The director of the Johnson Library told me, he told me a story about how there were presidents essentially are remembered in one sentence. And so the job of a presidential library director is to help define the right sentence for each of these presidents. And those sentences can change over time.
Well, and he, the former president, doesn't always get to choose that sentence. He isn't always in control of that afterlife destiny. We talked about George Washington, for example, and this over-the-top mourning and so forth. Thomas Jefferson, Brady, on his obelisk at his grave, specifically asked for language that noted three items from his career.
Yes, and they're not the three items that you would expect, because one of them is not being president of the United States. Jefferson wanted to put the three items that most mattered to him and what he felt he represented to the country. One was the Declaration of Independence, absolutely essential. It's just the cornerstone of his story and his legacy. Another was the Virginia, and I'll get the official name of it wrong, but the essentially the Declaration of Religious Rights in Virginia. Again, the idea of freedom of conscience was so important to him, and he felt that was important. The third often bewilders people because it's founder of the University of Virginia. You think, like, of all of the accomplishments that Thomas Jefferson had, first Secretary of State, third president, traveled all over the world, a great thinker of his time. Why that? And here's why. Because Thomas Jefferson saw, rightly, that the institution of slavery, in addition to being morally reprehensible, was having a great negative effect on the citizens of the state, both white and African American. He felt that the economy of the state was so tied to slavery, which was an economically inefficient institution, that the state was going backwards. Inefficient institution. It did not work well. All of the presidents who had great plantations died in debt. Jefferson was the greatest example of that. His family had to sell Monticello because it just didn't work as an institution, and it was horrible. But he saw the state moving backwards educationally and culturally. It was not the place that created the great thinker political philosophers as in the era of the founding fathers. It was simply creating these sort of crass politicians who cared more about defending slavery against those horrible Northerners than it did about thinking 50 or 100 or 200 years about the future of human beings and the rights of man and woman and so forth. He saw creating a world-class higher education institution as the antidote to that. If you create a University of Virginia that's as good as Harvard or Princeton or Brown or Dartmouth or any of the great institutions in Europe, then you'll start to see Virginia change course. And so he saw essentially his tombstone as a sales pitch for finishing the work that he had begun founding the University of Virginia, which was still a very young institution at that time. So this was his warning to future generations: keep this institution strong, make it into a centerpiece for Virginia, and the state, which he frankly cared more about than he cared about the entire country, would be strong, and that would benefit the entire nation.
So another part of Jefferson's afterlife, and you write a lot about this, Brady, you know where I'm going here, is his relationship with Sally Hemings and the possibility that he had, you know, several children with her.
And that was, I got to say, the hardest part of the book to write, because
it
is a very, very painful, difficult topic that is still in a lot of ways unfolding. A story that started hundreds of years ago. And it really, I mean, people so often say that the central question of America continues to be race. And this speaks to that question for not just him, but for all of us.
Well, and the issue of race, slavery, the Civil War is especially a sticky wicket for a lot of these presidential memorials. So we'll pick up that thread in just a moment, Brady. We'll keep taking your calls and emails as well. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, NHPR's Brady Carlson is here. His brand new book is called Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. Join us with your questions, comments, thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. As we look at some of the afterlives of our dead leaders, we'd love to hear from you. Who are some of the unsung presidents that you think deserve more afterlife attention? What's your favorite presidential monument, memorial, library that you visited? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Dot org. And Brady, before we go back to our listeners, let's talk about changing cultural norms, creating some real sticky wickets for these presidential memorials and libraries. We were leading up to that just before the break, Brady, when you talked about how those institutions memorializing Thomas Jefferson have had to deal with the issue of slavery. This is not just for Jefferson, though. Lots of presidents now, we look at them differently.
We do, because our own understanding of race and how it's played out over American history has been changing, and in very painful ways. I mean, it's a very, very difficult subject, and one that I found very hard to write about, because it was the one thing I wanted to make sure that I got right, that I did not tell this story in a way that trivialized or simplified this very complicated issue that has a lot of different sides to it, frankly. Just by way of context, Thomas Jefferson's wife died before he became president and made a promise to him that he never remarry. And this is important because it speaks to one of the many factors that people believe led to his probable relationship with Sally Hemings, an enslaved woman who lived at his plantation at Monticello. Thomas Jefferson was, is often presented as a person who, believed that slavery was an evil and a moral wrong and should eventually be done away with. But he never personally found a way to do that
in his own life.
In his own life, he had enslaved people on Monticello his entire life. And for years, there had been these rumors circling around him, even going back to the days of his presidency, about a woman on his plantation by which he had fathered several children. And those were initially written off because they were presented by kind of a gossip monger who was a part of the Washington, D.C. political culture. And so they said, well, the message must be wrong because the messenger is wrong. And over time, the rumors never quite died down. They would flare up periodically. They came back up again over the years of debate over slavery and whether it should be abolished. People would say, well, look at the moral evils going on in Thomas Jefferson's own backyard. And those were written off because of an absence of evidence. And when I say that, I should clarify, absence of evidence by the usual historical standards. There were no documents that Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson did not write in his diary, fathered another child today with Sally Hemings. I mean, there's no evidence along those traditional documentary lines. But there's plenty of oral historical evidence, which, as you remember, many African-American families were not allowed to read or write or go to school. So that was the only way that they could pass on their histories and their cultures. And for people who are descended through the Hemings line, that was a very powerful thing to know. I'm related to a president of the United States, not just a president, but the one who wrote the Declaration of Independence.
That became which says all men are created equal, by the way.
A point of pride for many people in that Hemings line. And so these stories stayed in culture for years and years. Many families didn't talk about them openly, but they were always passed down to the next generation. This became sort of the family story and the way that they defined themselves. And in the 1960s and 70s, you started to see books that didn't just pursue sort of the sordid side of Thomas Jefferson, but they started to look at the historical evidence and the absence of historical evidence and said, well, the only person who could have fathered these children on Thomas Jefferson's plantation was probably him. He was always there on the plantation at the time that Sally Hemings became president. Couple that with the historical evidence, the oral histories and things like that, and he is the most likely candidate. And because of that long conversation that had been going on, mostly by a Harvard historian, Annette Gordon-Reed, people found a way to do a DNA test between some of the descendants in the Hemings line and not Jefferson, but a male relative of Jefferson. And what they were able to conclude was that a male Jefferson was the father in these descendants, that there was a direct DNA connection. They couldn't tie it conclusively to Jefferson because of the way that DNA works, but they said a male Jefferson. And then Gordon Reed's work and other people's work were able to say, well, if we're narrowing it down to Jefferson's, here's the most likely candidate. Here's the interesting part. At Monticello, the nonprofit foundation that runs Thomas Jefferson's plantation as a historic site has agreed with that evidence, and they've come to the conclusion that, yes, there was a relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. The only part of Monticello that is not controlled by that nonprofit foundation is the burial plot, the cemetery where Thomas Jefferson is entombed and other members of the Jefferson family. And the Jefferson family, the official descendants, still control that plot of land. They control who can be buried there. And they have not accepted that conclusion. They have said that either further testing needs to be done or that the evidence is inconclusive or that Thomas Jefferson simply didn't do it. And so there have been members of the Hemings line who have said, well, I'm a Jefferson. I would like to be buried at the Jefferson plot along with Thomas Jefferson. And to this point, they've been turned away. They've said, you can't do that. And so we haven't had for, say, more than over the last decade or so, there is the talk has died down. But there's always been this undercurrent of tension about, you know, who belongs in that cemetery? And that speaks to that broader question that is always part of America and American history and American culture. Who is part of America? Who belongs as part of this American family? And how do we define ourselves as an American family? And the Jefferson family, in a way, is the microcosm of that bigger question.
You know, the Civil War, slavery, and so forth has, well, affected for sure the afterlives of many dead presidents of that era. And we have to talk about Franklin Pierce, the only president from New Hampshire. How did his difficulty with this North versus South question affect his afterlife, Brady?
Well, Franklin Pierce, the New Hampshire guy, wound up on the wrong side of history. He was one of those politicians who believed in the old way of the decades before him, that if people just loved the country enough, they would find a way to get along, even if they disagreed about what to be done about slavery, that they would put the Union first and they wouldn't try to break apart. And when he became president in the 1850s, most people had moved beyond that. They had said slavery is simply too big a question to just let lie there, and we can't simply just agree to disagree.
No more live and let live.
As Abraham Lincoln said, you know, the country can't stay as a house divided. It has to either become all one thing or all the other. And Franklin Pierce was trying in his arguably inept way to just try and keep everybody together for a little while longer and not try and make too many waves. And after the war, after all of those people had been killed and after all of that suffering and devastation and horror, people did not want to look back on him fondly. So there had been efforts to try and put a monument to Franklin Pierce in the state. He's the only president from New Hampshire. And for years and years and years, people said no. It wasn't until 1913 that the state finally said, we need to do something to honor the only person who had ever ascended to the White House from this state. And they didn't do it overlooking his record, which Franklin Pierce ranks in the bottom tier of presidents even today. But what they essentially squared him away, I call him the bi-local president, because in the same way that, you know, you go to a local farmer's market and you're buying not necessarily because it's the greatest produce in the world, although oftentimes there's great stuff, especially at New Hampshire farmer's markets, but you're doing it because buying local is important. It's a value that you subscribe to. It's something you believe in, that your neighbors are part of your life. It's part of your community, and your community is important. And so in a way, people were saying, well, Franklin Pierce may not be a great president, but he is our president. And it's important to be able to note to the country that presidents come from New Hampshire. And so we should at least put one statue out to him. He's not necessarily the most beloved person. His statue is not in the front of the New Hampshire State House. Daniel Webster is there, a man who argued so passionately for the Union and represented the state and the country so well. And some of the other leaders there, John Stark from the Revolutionary War era, and a U.S. senator who was believed to be the first to argue for the absolute abolition of slavery in the country. Those are the three statues that are in front of the State House. But Franklin Pierce is now out there, too. And so he has found his way back into the New Hampshire story.
Although it's interesting, and almost everyone listening has probably seen the statue, Brady, but it's worth noting that those three statues you mentioned in the middle are all sort of standing straight and chin up, and, you know, I don't think anybody's on horseback, but I can't remember, but they all look very sort of sturdy and confident. Franklin Pierce looks downcast. Yeah. It's a beautiful statue. It's very evocative, but he is not standing chin up, you know, staring you straight in the eye.
And he's on the outside of the official grounds.
Right.
He's actually just outside of the wall of the New Hampshire State House. So he's sort of on the outside looking in a way.
Yeah. Well, another example of the afterlife.
And you know, even his story, which is, you know, not Thomas Jefferson, still resonates. There was a few years ago, there was a bill in the New Hampshire legislature to establish a Franklin Pierce Day each year on his birthday. And they wound up politely turning it down because there was some controversy. Some members of the local NAACP said, well, let's remember what Franklin Pierce did about slavery while he was in office. Do we really want to push that any further than we already have? And apparently the legislature did not.
Well, and some of the fun pieces of this book, I mean, the whole book is a lot of fun, but some of the fun pieces for me were learning about these lesser known presidents like Franklin Pierce. Obviously, we know him here in New Hampshire. You visited a couple sites, Brady, of presidents who were less well regarded. You talk to the people who work at these memorial sites or these libraries, mostly smaller memorial sites of presidents long dead. And you kind of ask these people, what's it like to work for this place where people aren't that thrilled with the person memorialized?
Yeah, and it's interesting to see the answers that you get. I mean, Andrew Johnson, who was the president right after Abraham Lincoln.
Who was impeached.
He was impeached, yeah. And he says one of his toughest jobs is explaining to people what impeached means, that he was tried for potentially being removed from office but wasn't actually removed from office.
How many times a day does he say that?
Yeah, every day. That's the question I get. Why did they kick him out? And he said they didn't kick him out. And so he has to try and put Andrew Johnson's story into context, which he does in a rural part of eastern Tennessee, which is very far off the beaten path. But he does it, and he loves telling the story, and he loves sort of opening people's minds to not only Andrew Johnson's story, not really apologizing for what he did as president, but really explaining who he was and why he still matters, even though he's largely forgotten today. And you see museums and historic sites like that across the country. There are people who are doing this unheralded work. One of my favorites is in Southwest Ohio, where there's a museum that's partly dedicated to William Henry Harrison's family. There's a forgotten president. He was only in office for 30 days before he died. But they trudge away and they do their best just to try and make sure that, you know, that part of the American story is told too, along with the ones we all know.
Well, that's a really interesting one because you're right. In office for 30 days, famously didn't wear a coat and a hat, gave this incredibly long inaugural speech. What was he thinking? It was freezing cold. He gets pneumonia. He dies. By the way, Brady, you answer a question in the book that I've always wondered. Why didn't he just put his coat on? Listen
right
to your mother. It's
what
cold outside.
What was he thinking? Yeah, I mean, William Henry Harrison is a godsend to all those parents trying to get the kids to put their coats on before they go out in the cold weather. Here's what William Henry Harrison was doing that day. He was one part of it was he was a guy who lived, he was sort of a rural kind of unkempt guy, lived in rural Indiana, not known for being the most formal military man. So he walked around without a coat a lot of the time. And in fact, a couple of weeks later, after the inaugural address, he went out walking around in the cold and rain in Washington, D.C., and that may have actually impacted his health much more than the inaugural address, the famous moment. The other piece of it was he was trying very hard to show that he was physically and intellectually up to the job. He was the oldest president elected up to that time. He was in his late 60s. And he was thought of as, you know, kind of a well-meaning, bumbling guy, not he's no Thomas Jefferson intellectually or something like that. So he said, well, I'll show him. I'll just write this really long speech that talks about the ins and the outs of the veto power and the historical use of different powers of the presidency. And when that wasn't enough, he started moving on to Roman history. So there's a lot of proconsuls and Roman figures in that speech as well. And Daniel Webster, of course, of New Hampshire fame, edited the speech down, but it was still so long. And so that's what William Henry Harrison was trying to do when he gave that speech out in the cold with no hat and no coat on, speaking for hours and hours. And the interesting piece is that even as we talk about him in these didactic terms of, you know, put your coat on, man, that may not actually have been what killed him. There's some research in the last few years that say that maybe it was the water and sewer system, which was so poor in Washington, D.C. at the time, that maybe that killed him. And it wasn't the pneumonia or the cold or his bad decisions about what to wear in the cold at all.
Although his grandson, who ascended to the presidency, made a point of wearing, I think you said, like leather underclothes. So
he was not taking any chances. He wanted to stick around.
Well, Brady, last question, and I apologize for doing this to you at the end, but you do write that one theme we see over and over again with presidents, especially those who are assassinated, is controversy over how they died, especially when they die in office. The number one example, Brady, is the assassination of JFK. We won't go into that whole thing right now, obviously. But in general, you say that JFK shows how presidential deaths are, the, by their very nature, ripe for conspiracy theories. Why?
Because presidents are so important and so powerful and so indicative of how we see ourselves as a system of government and different from the rest of the world, that they can't just die. That something has to have killed them.
They can't just die a peaceful death.
You can't just die a peaceful death. You can't just die of old age. You can't die of a heart attack or something like that. There's been conspiracy theories with every single president who has died in office. And some of them,
really,
on their face, are completely outlandish and impossible to believe. But they linger because, and it's not just simply about the facts of each case, but it's simply about the fact that we believe so heavily in our presidency, even if we don't necessarily care for the particular president at the time, that they can't die the way that the rest of us do. They have to have something cause their death. And perhaps the bigger, more suspicious, the more sinister, the better.
Well,
or the worse, I guess.
And the presidency is you know, obviously very political by nature. So maybe it's understandable, Brady. Someone dies in office. We think it's got to be political.
Yeah. Our first question, isn't how can we remember them, but who did it?
Well, Brady, so much more we could have talked about. I did want to let everybody know, since we're talking about, you know, presidential history, presidential monuments, memorials, I was in D.C. this week with one of my sons for February break, visiting some of these very memorials that you talk about. You were there on a book tour. I want to let the audience know we ran into each other.
Yeah, yeah. And we didn't plan it that way.
No, we did not.
We literally ran into each other on the streets of D.C.
Yeah, as you were exiting the metro and I was going in with my son, it was such a funny moment that just in honor of today's conversation, Brady, we had to put that picture that my younger son took up on our website. So if you want to see it, there it is, nhpr.org/exchange. Brady, what a blast. Thank you so much and good luck with the book.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's NHPR's Brady Carlson, our weekend edition host and a reporter and author of the brand new book, Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. This is The Exchange on NHPR.